takes me more time than anyone else.
Council can make your way to the council tables. Thank you for your patience. The next case on our calendar today is A18-1623, Marcia A. Hammond versus Jeffrey Lyle Buchanan. Parties will each have 15 minutes for their argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Take whatever time you need to get organized. I know we went long on the last argument, so I appreciate your patience. And when you are ready, if you can state your name for the record and the party you represent, and you can adjust the podium as necessary. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Amy Joyce, and I represent the appellant, Jeffrey Buchanan. Mr. Buchanan moved the district court for a modification of his spousal maintenance obligation based on three factors: a reduced need of the recipient, an increased income of the recipient, and a reduced income of the payor. The trial court failed to make particularized findings on these issues, and therefore it must be reversed and remanded back to the court for a finding consistent with what the record represented and the facts. So the first ground that we had for modification was Ms. Hammond's.
Ms. Joyce, on that issue, I would agree with you that there don't seem to be particularized findings on, for example, whether respondents' expenses were reasonable or not. There do seem to be sort of an overall, as in this item and the car and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But overall, why couldn't we affirm saying, well, the court heard evidence in the record on all these things, and the court clearly must have rejected those arguments as to expenses, and rejected your arguments as to income, and overall the findings would encapsulate that. Now, why is that wrong?
Well, Your Honor, it's wrong for a couple of reasons.
Okay.
First, the court was required to perform the analysis of the budget, and they are required to look at that budget as of the time of modification. And they need to do the analysis to determine whether the expenses are consistent with the marital standard of living. The court didn't do that. And in fact, the facts in the underlying matter, the recipient actually testified in her deposition that she had inflated her expenses. They included expenses for an adult child, and that they were not consistent with the marital standard of living. That was the lower court blatantly ignoring the facts on the record. And I believe that that alone warrants remanding and a reanalysis or a new look by a lower court. The second reason it's not accurate.
In what case, what case should we look to? Let's say, for the sake of argument, we agree with you. What case would we look to say that's what has to be done? There have to be particularized findings on this in order for us to conduct a meaningful review as to whether the district court's findings were supported by the record.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the court can look to statute, Minnesota statute, and
okay.
They would
also... Which deals
also,
with the factors.
Yes, the factors.
The factors. Fair enough.
And they would also look to... Now, there's a lot of case law on this.
I bet there is. I'm sure you know it better than I do.
They would look to, I believe, Curtis and Lee, Your Honor.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
We've cited to that pretty extensively in our briefs.
Your client had the burden not only to show a substantial change in circumstances, but also that it results in an order that's unreasonable and unfair, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the district court found that he had not satisfied that burden. Isn't that an independent reason to deny the motion?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I don't believe that alleviates the lower court's obligation to look at the facts in order to determine whether it's reasonable and fair. And the court didn't do that here. What they did is they said, and I'm not sure if the court has looked at the transcript from the hearing, the court actually said, we're going to adjust this. There is absolutely evidence in the record as to why this would be considered unreasonable and unfair. And there's some other factors, too, that I think that it's important for the court to keep in mind. We're talking about 20 years of spousal maintenance at an incredible rate. Aside from that, this is a woman who no longer has all of the expenses that she had at the time of the divorce.
But, I mean, the amount of reduction that you were claiming was not significant in light of the dimensions of his income, right?
Well, Your Honor, I would like to address that, and there's a couple of points that we make in our brief about the dimensions of his income. So, for example, in 2001, the court found that Mr. Buchanan was making approximately $425,000 to $444,000. And in 2018, when he retired, we had an expert come in and apply the standard acceptable 4% conservative return on his investments, which puts him at approximately $440,000 a year. The court said, well, that's the same income, but it's not. And they failed to take into consideration what that value of that money is today. You certainly can't say that $400,000 in 2001 is the same $400,000 or buys the same as it does in 2018 or 19. So I think the court failed in that respect.
Well, I guess my question had to do with the fact that if her expenses had gone down, it was by relatively modest amounts in the scheme of things here. I mean, don't you think the district court had enough information to say, even if her expenses, you know, had gone down that much, or whether they're reasonable or not, still, whatever changes have occurred do not create a situation that's unfair and unreasonable?
I think that the court had enough information to say the exact opposite of that, Your Honor. And not only that, but they also had to look at it from the perspective of she has income. And they didn't do any analysis on the fact that she has investment income. She has Social Security income.
Well, but how much is her actual investment income?
Her actual investment income, we applied the same 4% return, Your Honor.
Well, that's not actual. That's your modeling, or you're hypothesizing about what it could be.
Yes, Your Honor, we are hypothesizing, but we are using a standard that the court is familiar with and that we use in almost every case. And when you look at the respondent's brief, she talks about, well, I've got this money invested for growth. That's not appropriate in this case. We have a woman who will be 70 years old in approximately a year. She needs to be, and she's required to invest her assets prudently to produce income for herself, regardless of whether Mr. Buchanan has the ability or has a significant amount of money. That's not the appropriate analysis. The analysis is, what does she need to meet the marital standard of living? It's less than what she needed in 2001, and she admits it. The second analysis,
under the statute, in order for there to be a modification, doesn't there need to be a showing of a substantially increased or decreased gross income or a substantially increased or decreased need? And so what is the evidence of a substantial change in one or more of those regards?
Okay. Your Honor, there's actually three. It is substantially increased or decreased income of the payor, substantially increased or decreased need of the recipient, substantially increased or decreased income of the recipient. And here we had all three of those.
But I guess, and I recognize that, but I'm asking specifically, what makes it substantial in this case? I mean, there's evidence of a decreased need, but what makes it substantial?
The substantial is generally referred to as a 20% move one way or the other. So, if, for example, if we look at Mr. Buchanan's change in income, if he is, and we, you know, again, we did the analysis to figure out what is that income worth today. The difference between $400,000 in 2001 and $400,000 in 2018 is approximately $130,000. That is a significant change in circumstances. With regard to her income, she has investment income and she has Social Security. Now, perhaps the court doesn't see that as a substantial amount, but it is an amount.
Wait a minute. Social Security.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is she taking benefits?
She should be. I don't know if she is.
Well, isn't that important? I mean, you say she has Social Security. She's eligible, but I believe the record indicates that she's not drawing benefits.
Well, Your Honor, she is voluntarily not drawing benefits, and that should not be to the detriment of my client.
You talked earlier about prudence. I mean, it's often prudent to delay the taking of benefits until 67 or 70. It increases the monthly amount, so that could be a prudent decision on her part.
Your Honor, I don't believe that it is. And for the sole purpose that she's now 69 years old, she will be 70. She has the income available to her. And looking at the totality of the circumstances that are involved here between these parties, it's fair and equitable that she should, at a minimum, get her Social Security benefits that she is entitled to. I mean, to argue that you have the luxury of delaying just so that your ex-spouse has to make up the difference, I just think it's unfair and inequitable.
But on a modification motion, at step one, in determining need, I think we can look more generally at resources or property, you know, that's available to provide self-support. But on a modification motion, as Judge Cochran said, aren't we looking at the actual income that the person has experienced at the time of the hearing or in the recent periods?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that there is a slight distinction there in that you were to look at the available income.
And what's your authority for that?
Your Honor just cited to it, but if the court looks at Taylor v. Taylor, that court found that you must consider Social Security income when determining spousal maintenance.
That court find you must look at potential Social Security income or actual income that's being received?
I believe that court found that available was the word that was used.
Okay, thank you.
The other issue, there are some very significant adjustments to this budget that should have been made, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because we do go into detail in it in the brief. But for example, $1,500 a month in clothing, which amounts to $18,000 a year, that the recipient of the spousal maintenance testified was in part for her adult child. So there are some very significant expenses in there. They had an expert that came in and opined about she needs this much to meet her spending. Well, but her spending is not equal to or not in line with the marital standard of living. And she left the marriage with very little debt. She is now including $600 a month in interest payments on significant debt. So I would argue to the court that there are some very significant adjustments that should have been made. And at a minimum, there should have been some particularized findings about why or why not those adjustments weren't made. The same argument goes for the income. The court had to attribute that income to the recipient. I don't believe that they had the option of just ignoring it and not making any findings about it. In addition, we've argued that under Curtis, there is an obligation not to waste marital assets that are awarded to you in a divorce. 20 years ago, Ms. Hammond received a home that had over $400,000 in equity that certainly would be significant now. And instead of maximizing on that, she drained all the equity from it, sold it, and didn't have any residual leftover money. It was like $7,000.
District Court found that she has not squandered resources, right?
I believe that they did find that, Your Honor. And that is part of our appeal today.
I'm unclear on, do we know exactly what his income was at the time of the divorce? I mean, I understand there's references to more than 400,000. It seems like we ought to have a more precise number from the record of the prior proceeding.
Your Honor, we do not have a more precise number. It was, we were working with what was in the record in the stipulated judgment and decree. That's the best that we can do. But I don't think that the argument changes as far as the analysis, because either way, even if his income were greater, it certainly is a significant change to what he's making today.
And it seems like, I mean, your argument with respect to his income, that there's been a substantial change in circumstances. I think that argument hinges on the premise that the district court was obligated to adjust for inflation. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, and admittedly that is a new area. I would argue that there's virtually no case law on it, and I think it's going to become a very significant area of inquiry because population is aging. And it's not common for there to be a circumstance where you've got a 20-year payment of spousal maintenance and somebody's income, while still substantial, she's getting cost of living increases, right, every 2 years in her spousal maintenance. We must afford the payor that same benefit and analyze that money as what it would be worth today versus what it was worth 20 years ago. You know, Mr. Buchanan had a very successful business, and he worked very hard to grow that business. And the fact that his lifestyle improved and went up over the course of 20 years, it doesn't inure to her benefit that he worked hard and developed this business. You know, and he ought not be required to cut back on his standard of living in order to fund an inflated and budget that's not representative of the marital standard of living. So we would ask this court respectfully to remand.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Rebecca Chafee on behalf of respondent Marsha Hammond. Before the court is a permanent spousal maintenance case. Appellate case law tells us that each spousal maintenance case is very individualized and very unique in its facts. And this case certainly epitomizes that. Here, the appellant had the dual burden to demonstrate not just a substantial change in circumstances, but also that if there was a substantial change in circumstances, that the existing order was unreasonable and unfair. The district court found that the appellant did not meet his burden on either of those factors. There are three main issues that the appellant has raised as far as establishing a substantial change in circumstances. With regard to my client's income, the appellant had argued that Social Security income should be considered. As Ms. Joyce just argued, the case law does speak to whether Social Security income should be considered. As we've cited in our brief, the Swanstrom case, a Court of Appeals case from 1984, demonstrates that the district court has the discretion to determine whether future Social Security income is considered or not. And it is not an abuse of discretion for the court to not consider such future Social Security income. The record is very clear that—
Does it have to explain why it does or doesn't?
Your Honor, I think within the discretion of the court has the ability to look at the income as the parties are receiving at the time of the motion. In this instance, husband conceded that appellant was not, or rather respondent was not receiving such Social Security income. So I don't know that an explanation is needed when the income itself is not even there. Certainly, if in the future respondent is receiving Social Security income, that could be an issue that is brought up on a later motion. But there would still be the issue of whether that increase of Social Security income is a substantial change in circumstances. With regard to the interest income that appellant argued my client is receiving or should be receiving, my client is not receiving 4% interest on her investment accounts. She's receiving a very nominal amount of income, and that income is being reinvested into those accounts. That was set forth in the evidence. And we need to look back at the standard of review here, which is, does the record support the findings, and do the findings support the conclusions of law? And certainly, with regard to the general statement that there is not financial a financial resource for my client to self-support, both with regard to the Social Security income and any argument as to investment income, this court made an accurate finding based on the record before it.
Are the district court's findings sufficiently detailed in terms of respondents' income and expenses?
Your Honor, our position at the hearing, and we had quite a discussion at the motion hearing about this, is that her income was zero because she did not receive Social Security income at the time, and her investment income, which was a nominal amount, was being reinvested. Our argument was that the court did not have to, was not mandated to impute any investment income to her, and by the court's findings, it adopted our position. So the fact that the court found and did not indicate that there was any income available for her to pay her own expenses is a sufficient finding. With regard to her expenses, the court made a very detailed finding that the $11,553 per month budget that was presented to the court was a credible budget. Now, the court's earlier comments were whether this was particularized enough, whether the court needed to have more detail or analysis going back and forth on each of the particular expenses. And I would submit that the court's adoption of the budget as a whole indicates that it did review those expenses. And indeed, the fact that it adopted all of the budget items does not mean it did not make a particularized finding regarding the expenses. The appellant argued that my client had made statements.
Then how do we know the $11,553 number is not an abuse of discretion?
Because the court found that the analysis that was completed was a credible analysis. This was not just an analysis where my client had thrown out a number and just said, this is my budget. This is an analysis by a third-party money manager who reviewed each of the bank statements and the credit card statements for all of the spending during the time at issue, which was for the entire year of calendar year 2017. And with that analysis, there was a spreadsheet that detailed each of the expenditures that had been spent. So this was not an estimated budget or a speculated budget or a I wish I was spending this amount of money budget. This was what she was actually spending and going in and out of her, or rather out of her accounts via payments every single month. And so it's with that analysis that the court deemed that to be an appropriate expression of what her particular budget was.
Ms. Chafee, there was some suggestion by appellant that your client was spending money on the child who had reached the age of majority. Did you first of all deny that, saying that wasn't the case?
No, Your Honor, we put the statement in context.
Okay.
So when appellant deposed my client, she did acknowledge that some money via groceries and dining out had been expenditures that the adult child had enjoyed. But this was not a transfer of cash assets or gifts of buying gift cards.
If your client was spending money, well, if some of the expenses that she's listed, including, you know, groceries on the child, would you agree that would not, that's not a legitimate expense?
Well, in this context, Your Honor, I would not agree. Context, okay. And the reason.
So you can include maintenance. In your calculation of expenses for the determination of maintenance, you can include money you're spending on your adult child who's living with you for groceries and, I don't know, whatever, clothes or something.
First of all, the adult son was not living in the home.
Okay. Well, but even if he wasn't, two of mine aren't, and I can assure you, you know, every now and then I send them a check. I don't know if that would be proper maintenance.
And I would agree, if there were checks being sent to an adult child.
But I guess the question is, if that's in dispute, and that could possibly be a problem, wouldn't we expect to see a finding saying either, no, that didn't occur, or yes, that is reasonable, or, you know, some variation, as opposed to, well, you know, the whole number is 11,553, so, you know, that's all fine. I mean, isn't that a problem?
I think there are times where orders could always be better explained.
But not this one.
Well, in this instance, Your Honor, I think we don't look at maintenance expenses in the vacuum of we never have any socialization or entertainment of any third party.
And I totally agree with that. I agree with you.
We have categorizations for gifts, for charities, for dining out, for entertainment, for having someone over to our homes. And in this instance, the spending that was purportedly for the adult child was in that context. That is, this adult child was coming over and having dinner with his mom. And to say that we need to now delineate how much of the meal is for the third party that's in your home, I don't believe that that's what our Minnesota statutes contemplate when it comes to spousal maintenance. I agree that if there were direct transfers to the adult child, those would not be appropriate expenditures for which appellant should be paying spousal maintenance. But there is no evidence that any such transfers existed in this case.
Well, in terms of her monthly budget, remind me what the expenses related to the adult child were.
So there was an allegation, I believe, if my memory is correct, primarily regarding groceries that were being purchased and regarding dining out, as I recall.
But it was a relatively small part of the budget. It wasn't 20% of the budget.
Well, my understanding is it wasn't 25% of the whole budget. It was her testimony at her deposition was it could be around 25 to 30% of her grocery budget.
Thank you.
Thank you. With regard to Mr.
And what was the, Ms. Tavey, what does the record indicate her monthly grocery budget was? If you can, if you don't have it at your fingertips, that's fine. But I guess my point is if it's, you know, if it's $1,000 and $500 of that relates to the child, I mean, it seems to me that expense, you know, shouldn't be, you know, coming in.
Well, sure, but I think we still have to look at whether it's a substantial change
in
circumstances, that we have to look at the overall expenses. And when we're dealing with a budget that's about $12,000 per month, a couple of hundred dollars, which I believe is maybe what 25% of her budget might be, I think it might be actually less, I don't believe that meets the standard of a substantial change in a budget item, even if that was deducted from her overall budget. With regard to Mr. Buchanan's income, Your Honor, the district court made a finding that his income was at a level of $400,000 pursuant to the judgment and decree. The judgment and decree does reference that there is some additional return on his business asset, but it does not say whether that return is a dollar or any more than that. And based on the record that's before the court needed to make a finding as to what the income was, which the only known amount was $400,000 per year. Certainly,
and you're describing the situation in 2001.
That's correct, what the decree provides. Appellant argued during the motion hearing that the change of the income should be measured against 2015, which was when his income was in excess of $700,000. The district court correctly found that that was not the marker from which we measure this. Rather, we do go back to the date of the decree, which was the last order for spousal maintenance. There is absolutely no basis for the appellant's argument that inflation should be considered in determining whether or not there has been a change in income to date. And not only that, but there are no facts in the record to actually reflect what that inflationary amount was. So appellant made some arguments at the oral argument hearing on this motion and indicated what inflation should be, but no evidence has ever been presented to the court so that the court would even be able to adopt such findings if it had wanted to. So on each of the factors that the appellant had argued there is a substantial change in circumstances, there just simply isn't.
Do we know his income, actual income at the time of the motion?
We don't. Appellant actually did not provide his actual income. He did not even provide his 2017 tax return at the time of the motion. So we don't have complete information. Indeed, he only presented an argument about what his assets could potentially produce, and he used what he considered, quote, a conservative 4% interest rate. So on that basis alone, when someone's coming to the district court trying to demonstrate a substantial change in circumstances, it really is incumbent upon the obligor to actually provide proof of what his income is in order to make that case. And I think overall, the court looked at these arguments and looked at the position of the appellant, where he is telling the court he is spending $35,500 per month, each and every month, plus some additional expenses for his adult child that aren't included in that amount, and said, even if there are these changes or there are some small changes with regard to expenses or income, at the end of the day, it is not unreasonable and unfair to keep this existing spousal maintenance in place and to have this order continue, as it is a permanent award of spousal maintenance, and the appellant is required to meet his burden of proof and demonstrate that there is a substantial change in circumstances rendering the original order unreasonable and unfair. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Very briefly, I would like to speak to counsel's arguments. With regard to the Social Security issue, she cited to the Swanstrom case that you cannot consider future Social Security income. That case is distinguishable because it involved individuals who were 47 and 48 years old. So they were talking about future income 10, 15, 20 years down the road. We're talking about somebody who is already at and beyond retirement age. So it's not the same analysis, and it certainly doesn't speak to the circumstances of this case. Counsel also stated that the district court clearly reviewed the budget and found it acceptable, and that is just absolutely can't be true. And the reason is because the court did not talk about this adult child's expenses, and it wasn't just dining out, it wasn't just groceries. It was groceries, dining out, clothing,
medical expenses. What was the total amount relative to respondent's total budget?
Respondent's guesstimate was that it was around $1,000 a month. So, for example,
of the $11,553.
Yes. And under the ACIRCA case, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, the courts can't consider the adult child's expenses. I mean, this isn't a discretionary issue. This is something the court is required to exclude.
Do you agree that if they go out to dinner and she picks up the bill from the restaurant, that that's not a transfer to the child, but simply a customary means of socializing?
I would say that that would be already in her entertainment budget, Your Honor, and what my understanding of her testimony was that she was actually giving funds to him or paying for him for his entertainment, his food, not a situation where he's coming to have dinner with his mother. This is, I'm buying him groceries, I'm buying him acupuncture, I'm paying for his clothing. So I think that's a distinguishable but important point that Your Honor makes. This is not just, I'm having my kids over for dinner. This is very different from that. This is, I'm funding their lifestyle, and I'm doing it with my ex-spouse's money, and that just simply is not permitted.
Ms. Joyce, so did you say the ACIRCA case, that's referenced on page 7 of your brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And I'd also like to speak to the income at the time of the motion. Mr. Buchanan's income at the time of the motion, his wage income was gone. The only information that we are able to supply is to utilize something that is reasonable and accepted as to what his investment income will generate for him. So, you know, to suggest that we didn't provide the information we did, we had spending analysis, we had experts, we had all kinds of information that was available as
It wasn't the actual investment income, right?
No, Your Honor, because we didn't know it. We wouldn't have known because his official retirement date was December 31st. So just a little bit of factual background for the court. Mr. Buchanan sold his business and was to retire. They extended his employment at $120,000 a year for his income for a period of, it actually changed over the course, but for about 6 months, six, 7 months. And so he was earning the $120,000 per year on a consulting basis. And then as of December 31st, that income terminated entirely. So we didn't have years of information about what his investment income is generating because that the bulk or a significant portion of that came from the sale of the business. So it was just being invested, which brings up another point, and it's in our brief, but he doesn't have the same obligation that the recipient does. The recipient's required to invest their assets so as to produce income. She is investing her assets for growth. But nonetheless, we still took the position that there is income there. It just isn't sufficient to fund the budget at the level, and it is a significant change. Your Honors, we would submit again that we request that this be reversed and remanded. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. The arguments were well done, and the matter is submitted. We will take a brief recess. Judge Sleater will be substituting for Judge Connolly on the next case, and we will return in a couple minutes.
All right.
Rice, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Johnson, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Gene Cochran presiding.
Good morning. You can be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I apologize for the delay and thank you for your patience. Next case on our calendar is A19-0064, Christopher Christofferson versus Alpha Service Industries Incorporated. Parties will each have 15 minutes for their argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you can identify yourself and the party you represent for the record, I'd appreciate it. And if you need to adjust the podium, feel free to do so. You can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is A.L. Brown, and I represent the appellant, Christopher Christofferson, in the matter before the court. Hidden in this, what I think is a relatively small case, is a big principle of whether Minnesotans, under the Minnesota Health Records Act, have the ability to withdraw consent. The Minnesota Health Records Act is clear that a health care provider cannot, shall not, must not provide health records to a third party without the written consent of the subject of the records. At one point, Christopher Christofferson had given that consent, but it is unabashedly clear from the record that he withdrew that consent. He withdrew the consent in writing, limited it for the purposes of insurance, and then Alpha violated that consent and went forward. The district court, and we asked the court to reverse and remand the district court for two reasons. First, the district court made a legal error in the way that it interpreted the Minnesota Health Records Act. To this point, the district court was correct. The Health Records Act does not use the word revocable or irrevocable. And from that silence, the district court concluded that the consent was irrevocable. I think that is an error in law.
Is that what the district court said?
Well, that's the way I understand the district court's opinion. I understand that there's a difference of opinion on how to read that from the respondent's brief. But in order to get to the contract question, which is the second error of law that I believe the district court committed, it had to have concluded that the consent was not revocable under the statute. And so maybe not directly, but implicitly, the district court found that if the statute does not